welcome to the Friday, December 28th edition of the Clemson Dubcast, reporting to you from the Omni Hotel in downtown Dallas, Texas. Kind of a weird week. Christmas, obviously, but then also, obviously, Monday, Christmas Eve, came the bombshell about Dexter Lawrence. We did not have a podcast that day, but we're resuming it today, albeit a little bit later than usual. The schedule has been a bit hectic over here as we go through all the run-up to tomorrow's Cotton Bowl, but managed to wrangle one Ralph Russo, the national college football writer for the Associated Press. Really good guy. Really cool story about where he came from. The Bronx, New York, not exactly the football hotbed. Really enjoyed talking to him, talking about Dabo's rise, about Clemson fans, about dealing with fans in general. So really appreciate him joining us. Go to TigerIllustrated.com. Plenty of coverage we've had and will continue to have through the week, through tomorrow's semifinal game and beyond. I've enjoyed having Paul Strelo accompanying me here as we go through the week covering Clemson. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals. Went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581 or parhamlaw.com. Business owners out there, if you own a business that accepts credit cards, you need to listen up. Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, run by Clemson folks, is changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. Tandem's program saves you up to 90% on processing charges and gives your customers what they love most, choices. This is not some crazy introductory offer. Tandem's technology allows business owners to offset their credit card processing costs by applying a small customer service charge to each sale they make. If you want to know more, visit TandemPayment.com today. Former Tiger Hot Rod McDowell works over there at Tandem Payment. They handle all their business and customer service face-to-face. So give them a call, 864-672-1570, if you're tired of spending an arm and a leg on all those credit card processing fees. Okay, let's get to it. Our conversation with Ralph Russo, national college football writer for the Associated Press. Enjoy. All right, we're here with Ralph Russo, national college football writer for the Associated Press. I guess pardon the Christmas music in the background here at the Omni, all you Scrooges out there. Really appreciate you joining us, Ralph.
Oh, no problem, Larry. Yeah, actually, it's nice to have a little ambiance, right? It's like it sort of tells people that we're actually out in the field, right?
Yeah, we're taping this the day before the Cotton Bowl. And what is your take on this whole, the PED sensation, Dexter Lawrence sensation that is completely and unexpectedly overtaken the entire week?
Yeah, you know, it's funny when you come and cover these things, especially from a national perspective, because you're sort of covering both teams. You're covering the story of the game as opposed to one team. You know, on one hand, it's like, oh, well, let's hope nobody gets in trouble, right? I don't want to have to go chasing down cop reports, see if somebody got into a fight or got arrested at a bar. I'm certainly not excited about this story, but it's an interesting story because it does give a storyline to a week, right? I mean, you know, you're in the business of covering news, and this is real news, and sometimes these lead-ups can be a little dull, Luckily, Clemson is a program that sort of deals with things openly, so that's helped. You don't have to necessarily sort of dig behind the scenes, and there's been at least, they've been transparent, or at least they seem to have been as transparent. They seem to be trying to be transparent, and that's helpful. Having, you know, Dexter Lawrence come out and talk to the media was actually quite surprising. Again, you've been around a lot of programs. You know, I've covered Alabama a lot over the last few years doing this job, and I can't imagine them doing something like that and a lot of other programs. So that's helped, and it's made things interesting. It's also, listen, I have no horse in the race, but it's disappointing not to have one of the best players in the country not playing in the game. Disappointing for the kid, and disappointing again to the story, but it has made for an interesting week because it's given the week a storyline.
You talked about that sort of surprising full disclosure. On Monday when this broke, I know that Dabo and the folks at Clemson were wrestling with what to do, and he actually said in recent days, I could have done the standard suspended for violation of team rules and tried to keep it quiet, the specifics. But man, as I think about it, I think the disclosure was the right decision, because let's say you do put it under the umbrella of just suspended for violation of team rules, and then word leaks out at some point that it's PEDs, and then you lose control of the story at that point, right? I mean, is that sort of, you see what I'm saying?
Completely, and I think that is a place where a lot of college programs get it wrong. They sort of lose the perspective that if you tell the story, preferably truthfully, but if you tell the story, you get to control it to a certain degree. In the absence of information, that void will be filled in a way that you might not like. Right? Because I like to think there's a lot of responsible reporters that would have been able to fill in the story. But you're also risking, especially, listen, in this day and age, like rumor and innuendo has sort of replaced reporting to a certain degree. And there's a lot of good news organizations. But then, sometimes, a Twitter handle can get out of control. Mm-hmm. So without getting too deep into the weeds of like our business, I think that most college programs make a misstep in not getting out in front of these stories. And that goes beyond just college sports. Like getting out in front of a problem is generally the best approach PR-wise. So again, commendable for Clemson to do that. But again, it also is a good strategy as far as controlling it, right? I think that when you start to have people poke around, sometimes you never know what else gets uncovered here. And listen, if Clemson wins, especially if Clemson wins, there's going to be a lot of people sort of poking around to try to learn a little bit more about what's going on and what happened in this situation. It's weird. Right? Yeah. It's a weird situation. And I like to think that Clemson is providing truthful information, but even if they are, they don't know all the story because they're still trying to figure it out.
What are your two or three biggest questions right now about it?
This does not seem like something, if it is what they say it is, which is this substance, ostarine, it does not seem, as far as my research and, sort of trying to reach out to some experts, like something that you could stumble into taking. It's not over the counter. It's not available over the counter or even by a prescription, as far as I can tell. So then, how exactly does it get into Dexter and the other couple of players? The other thing, I guess, and this is more of sort of the technical side of this, because I haven't had a chance to like pin down a good doctor to sort of take me through this. Tried to get one today who works in the Olympic sphere, and they're on vacation, which is, happens a lot at this time of the year. My other part of that is, are there false flags? Are there other ways this can get into your body that don't involve simply ingesting it? Or again, are there other substances that can possibly, that would be necessarily above board, that can somehow trigger or cause a false flag for this. And again, that's very naive, me very naively talking about a subject that I don't know a ton about, which actually, let me just turn one quick thing to also add to that. The one thing I think that hasn't been in Clemson's best interest, listen, we love talking to Dabo because he fills up the tape recorder. I think Dabo's inclination to talk and expand on subjects probably hasn't been best served right now, just because there's a lot he doesn't know. And his inclination to sort of expand and explain, probably he might want to tame that in, because he's risking running into an area where he inadvertently provides misinformation. And again, that's not a major criticism of Dabo. Generally speaking, we like his approach. But I do think that, like, with so much unknown, it's probably best for him to not elaborate that much.
The first day on Monday, the first thing that came to my mind, okay, Dexter Lawrence within the last year had foot surgery. Braden Galloway, the freshman tight end, also had foot surgery. Zach Giella, I was told yesterday, I knew he was injured during the spring. He missed some time. Robbie Caldwell, the offensive line coach, told me he had knee surgery. And so, you know, you're trying to find common threads. And so you hear, you know, they don't work out together. They're not from the same position groups and this and that. I'm not saying that that is the common thread that's going to reveal something. I'm just saying that seems to be the only common thread that I can think of. They're recovery from surgery.
Yeah, the one thing that I, again, just very, you know, Google scientist here, you know, reading up on this substance, is that it sometimes is used to treat osteoporosis. So again, you start like putting two and two together. Is it possible within the rehab they were taking something that maybe could have included this or something like it? So again, right, I mean, I think we're all in the same boat as you. And again, you have far more knowledge about the team, about the inner workings of Clemson than I do. But again, looking for those common threads and something like that, when we had talked about it earlier, like, is sort of a light bulb, like, okay, well, at least there's something that sort of puts these players, gives them something in common. Because again, from my perspective, even not knowing the inner workings of the team, I sort of know the way teams in general work. And a junior defensive tackle is not likely to be hanging around a lot with a freshman tight end. That's just not the way football teams operate, generally speaking. So again, what sort of puts them in, what sort of gives them things in common? I'd be interested to see I think it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. There's an appeals process with the NCAA. Even if this works out in Lawrence's and the two other players' favor in the long run, I question how quickly it can move for Clemson's benefit for next week's game, if they beat Notre Dame for the next week's game. Because listen, the fact of the matter is, Dexter probably won't be back.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's unfortunate he could miss his last two games, but he's going to be moving on. I'd like to see what happens for the other kids, but the most urgent need, I just don't know if the NCAA is capable of moving that quickly on this to get it settled by January 7th.
Yeah, the other two are looking at missing the entire 2019 season. And Dexter, he told me yesterday, he said he has not made a decision. Mm-hmm. I mean, you would think he's going pro.
You would think.
But stranger things have happened, like last year at Clemson.
That's a good point.
And so if you're like a Clemson fan and you're thinking this could, you know, if there was a chance he could come back, and now this throws that out the window. That's another, I guess, unfortunate byproduct. We're talking about the transparency of Clemson. How much better would it be for everyone if the NCAA were more transparent in situations such as this?
Yeah, I've had those conversations with people at the NCAA.
All right.
And I think in some ways they recognize that. Like, and when I say people, maybe the deepest conversation hasn't been with Mark Emmert, but I've literally mentioned that to Mark Emmert. Not that we're buddies, but we cross paths enough. Mm-hmm. And other people who are sort of in the positions of PR and handle the ability to be transparent. I think that anytime you're working in the, to use a corporate term, the collegiate space, higher academics, it becomes very tricky how much you can reveal about the students. It's just, I think, as simple as that. Now, sometimes that's cover, and sometimes that's very true. And I think the nature, and again, we see it at working, at covering colleges. As transparent as Clemson could be, I'm sure there have been points when you found yourself frustrated because they decided to, you know, put up the shield of student protection.
Sure.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the NCAA finds itself in those positions a lot. I do think it would help if they were more transparent. I do think they make some effort if you can talk it out mm-hmm. with them to be a little more transparent. But it's just the nature of the business is behind a wall of student privacy.
I've talked with you and several other national writers in the last few days, just bouncing sort of ideas off of people who are more, you know, familiar with the NCAA and dealing with them. And my question is, on a non-specific question, like, that could provide a lot of clarity, like, how many previous cases mm-hmm. involving Osterine have there been? How many of those previous cases have been overturned, not overturned? Mm-hmm. It would seem, in each of the conversations I've had, it's been like, good luck getting them to even respond to you, you know?
Well, and so it, I would say I wouldn't be quite so skeptical. I would say, because I think we're all going to ask those questions, and maybe because it's such a high profile situation, there's probably a little urgency there. Now, again, I will give a little leeway to the fact that we are between Christmas and and New Year's, and there is just a practicality to the fact that a lot of people are not available to do the research, maybe. But again, if we have a Clemson victory in the Cotton Bowl and this thing lingers on. Now, again, this is a story that you're going to be following even when we're past the playoff, right? Because the other two players are still going to be Clemson players next year. And you're right. It's not just the suspension is a calendar year, which I think people need to be familiar with, so that their suspension starts today. Mm-hmm. And which would wipe out all of next season for those two players. And that's a big deal for those players. So, I think that maybe some of that information might be able to be gleaned. It's just a matter of, I let's put it this way. I wouldn't stop anybody from reaching out, but we'll see how quickly they can respond.
What's your story? Where are you from? How long have you been covering college football for the AP? Mm-hmm. What's your background?
All right. So I grew up in New York City, in Queens to be specific, which is not necessarily a hotbed of college football, right? And I think people, the question I get a lot of is how did you get into college football? Because I spent the majority, I live in New York now. I left for a little while, but the vast majority of my life I spent in New York. And the best way I can describe it is, you know, when you're like 12, 13 years old on a Saturday, like those games, and there was not many of them on TV, from places like Lincoln, Nebraska, and Baton Rouge, and Clemson, like that might as well have been Mars. Like that was fascinating to me. These schools, I didn't really know where they were, playing in, you know, half-cut jerseys, playing these offenses that you didn't see on Sunday when I was a Jets fan and I would watch Jets games with my dad, and all of the sort of mystery and like uniqueness of that just pulled me in. So I became sort of a very big college football fan, like in Nebraska. I don't really remember Nebraska Clemson, that game in 1981, mm-hmm. I mm-hmm. guess it would have been. Yeah. But the following year when Nebraska had that monster team that ended up losing to Miami in that great Orange Bowl, that was the year that really hooked me. Being in the Northeast, there's not a lot of teams in the Northeast, but like a lot of people, I sort of got drawn to Penn State. Mm-hmm. Russo, obviously Paterno, you know, they always seem to have some nose guard named Esposito or, you know, something like that on the team. So Penn State ended up sort of drawing me in. And so that's sort of where it started. And so my love for college football started there, stayed with me through college. I went to school, the Fordham in the Bronx. And then when I got into the business, again, it was always sort of there. But the linchpin was I moved to Colorado for a while, worked for the Denver Post. I've worked for AP out of college and then left AP, moved to Colorado, worked for the Denver Post. So that's obviously, you know, now you're talking Big 12 country at the time. gets a little more interesting. Didn't really cover CU, but gets a little more interesting. After that, I went from Colorado back to the AP, but in Jackson, Mississippi.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Covering Ole Miss and Mississippi State and Southern Miss. And when you're in that part of the world, now I had the bug. And it's sort of just gone on from there.
So at Fordham on Saturday afternoons in the fall, are people like, what the hell are you watching, man?
You know, there's a lot of Notre Dame fans at Fordham.
That's true.
It's a Jesuit school, but Notre Dame is not, but a lot of Catholic, a lot of Irish Catholics at Fordham. So there was a lot of kids who were certainly very interested in Notre Dame. Like a lot of college campuses, there was a lot of kids betting on college football. So that drew us in. And you know, simply being a sports fan. But yeah, no, clearly I tended to know more about college football than most of my peers. While most of them watched the games to sort of figure out who the Giants or Jets were going to draft, I was sort of watching with more of a deeper interest.
How long were you in Mississippi?
About four and a half years. The standard line I use is, just like Ole Miss, I rode Eli Manning to big things. I started my career the year before in Mississippi, the year before Manning took over as a quarterback down there. But when Eli did take over, he was a big national story, right? So all of a sudden there was a spotlight put on Mississippi, and I just happened to be the person there to write. So I think that helped me get a little attention. In the AP is a big world, right? We have sports writers everywhere covering everything, and it's easy to sort of become just part of the background. But all of a sudden, you have this star player, unique perspective, because Eli's already, because Peyton's already a star, and obviously Archie. And it gave me an opportunity to sort of get on a little bit of a bigger, just like Ole Miss. Ole Miss sort of rose up and became an SEC contender, got on a big stage. It allowed me to get on a little bigger stage, and I think it helped my career a lot.
How long have you been national college football writer?
I took over in 2005.
Okay.
Excuse me, 2004. I moved back to New York and moved into this national role.
I am fascinated, Ralph. And how the national writer such as yourself, I was talking to George Schroeder and Dennis Dodd the other day, like, how do you guys do this? Like, how do you stay on top of so many different schools? Like, I cover one school, and there are some difficulties with it, but if something happens, I'm going to know about it because somebody's going to text me, or, you know, I'm going to know about it pretty quickly, whereas you guys have to be, it seems like, constantly plugged in to social media or whatever to monitor what's happening. Is that...
There's a lot of that. There is a lot of the idea. I mean, you know, I could try to make myself look good and say, you know, there are 130 FBS teams and I love them all the same. I definitely have an interest in all of them. But, you know, Clemson is really good right now. So I have to make it my priority. I have to put a certain emphasis on Clemson and making sure I have some contacts there and like that Dabo knows me, right? Maybe he doesn't know me as well as he knows Larry Williams, but Dabo and the guys, Tim Beret and now his predecessors, they know me at Clemson. So I try to get a certain level of, I guess, what's the word I'm looking for? Interaction with just about every school in the country.
Wow.
To the extent they at least know who I am, right? So if something goes, because, like, you know, I always say, like, you know, you say, well, what's the difference if you don't know what's going on at Georgia State? Well, you know what? Sometimes weird things happen, right? Sometimes players die. Sometimes coaches get involved in scandals. And they don't always pick the big schools when these sometimes off the rails things happen. And the big story doesn't always land in the big places. So you need at least some reach into everywhere. Just even if it's only to the extent of like, hey, you know me, right? I mean, it's a lot of like looking at Twitter. And quite frankly, it's a lot of watching guys like you. It's knowing that like, okay, I have to follow a beat writer for just about every team in the country, right? And like, you know, reading up, so much of it is literally just reading up, like, hey, what's going on in this one? What's going on in that one? And listen, you can't cover them all, but you try to be aware of everything. You know, there's the other part of it is when it comes to sort of like the reporting part, you are embedded at Clemson and you know far more people at Clemson than I could ever know. Where I might me or a guy like George Schroeder or Bruce Feldman or Pete Thamel, if you sort of go up the chain here, might have an advantage over a local reporter is we have some sort of national sources, be it an agent, be it a lawyer, be it, you know, someone who deals with contracts, be it coaches who have sort of come in and out of the game where maybe you don't necessarily pass through those people, who are able to sort of connect the dots, right? What's going on at X school? Oh, I know a coach at Y, and he worked with W, and I can sort of get lunch. So you sort of, you connect, you know, college football is probably not as big a world as we make it out to be. Like everything else, it's a pretty small world. So you're able to sort of connect the dots in some ways to get information sometimes in roundabout ways.
So let's say, okay, Georgia State, you mentioned. You develop a relationship with a sports information director or a coach there. What's the intended benefit? Like, okay, so if something happens, call me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what, I mean, is that the...
It's call me, or I think more often than not, it's accept my call.
Okay.
Right? It's...
Access.
It's when... Because listen, maybe if it's Georgia State, it's one thing, but let's just take an average ACC school. North Carolina, right? I mean, there's a lot going on in North Carolina, right? A lot of beat writers. I don't necessarily expect the people at North Carolina, whoever the contacts are, right? Whoever the people with information, be it coaches, SIDs, athletic directors, to have to respond to me first when there is a big story, because they have their own local media. And I understand that. But I want them to respond to me. Mm-hmm. I want them to just be able to. So again, they may not pick up the phone and call me first, but they will respond to my text or respond to my call. And that's what I mean. That's what I need. I need to be in the game to a certain degree. Yeah.
Proud sponsor of the Dubcast is the Abernathy Boutique Hotel. A short Trevor Lawrence throw from Death Valley. Man, it is a favorite for the ESPN folks who come into town, who stay there various times of the year. Also, man, it is booked up and packed to the gills for home football weekends. It has really caught on for people who want to come in and stay. Also, Taps Bar and Cafe, a really cool spot to go hang out during the week. If you want to grab a drink with some friends, some of you professors out there who want to wind down after work, laid-back alternative to some of the more boisterous college bars in downtown Clemson. So go check them out if you already haven't. Got some really good beers on tap, including my favorite, the Hugie Street IPA. So check them out online at theabernathy.com. I'm trying to put myself in 1995 pre-internet, and that might as well be 200 years ago in the shoes of a national college football AP writer. How did you find... There's no Twitter, obviously. There's no internet. How did you keep tabs on stuff then?
Well, that's a good question. You know, again, a little before my time.
Yeah, you're before your time. But
nonetheless, I mean, I know some people who have sort of done it back then. I think the difference is you didn't keep... You weren't expected to necessarily chase down every coaching move, right? I think that the world that we have come to is we have, and you know, again, like I don't want to necessarily even put myself at that level, but you have the guys like Bruce Feldman and Pete Thamel who are literally able to be on top of every coaching move practically in the country, right? That just wasn't expected back then. That was a point when the local reporters probably had better... you know, the local reporters sort of did their thing. And the other thing was, you know, and even now, we have local reporters all over the country. So that's another thing. And I really should add to that. When you say, like, how do I do my job and stay on top of everything? Well, the fact of the matter is, I have Eric Olson in Lincoln, Nebraska, who does a great job of covering the Huskers. And we have Pete Iacobelli in South Carolina, who splits his time between Clemson and South Carolina and University of South Carolina. He does a great job there. So it's not all on me. I really have to emphasize that. It's not all on me. My job is to help those colleagues in any way I can to provide information. And sometimes more help is necessary because those people have coverage responsibilities beyond just maybe Clemson. And sometimes I can step back and go, you know what? You got this thing locked down. I'm going to go focus my attention on another school.
I guess, how do you decide where to go each week during the football season? Mm-hmm. Is it up to you?
It is somewhat up to me. Now, that's changed through the years, too. Game day coverage is not what it used to be, mm-hmm. right? I'm sure you know that through your web, through watching what readers like to read, right? Because you can track that really well. And those Saturday night stories that post maybe don't do as well as a Thursday night, story about recruiting, right? Right. So with that, I don't go to as many games as I used to. I spend a lot more Saturdays sort of summing up the country, and they'll say, you know, just get your five screens and watch them all and write a wrap-up column that ties everything back to the big themes of the weekend. And that does pretty well nowadays. That's a big shift. The only problem with that is I do need to show up places, referring back to what we talked about before, because I need to have some kind of interaction with these schools to build up sources. So the push and pull is like Saturday. The copy doesn't necessarily drive as much as it used to, but it's still important for me to go places.
Yep.
So maybe it's not a game, maybe it's during the week. You know, listen, we all got budget restrictions now that we didn't have maybe 15, 20 years ago. So the mechanics of the business have changed from that standpoint. But generally speaking, I will say, hey, here are the two or three games I think we should go to. What are our local staffing situations? Here's the reasons why I'd like to go there beyond just covering the game. And then we make decisions from there.
You said five screens. Is that at your house?
I that's probably a little bit of an overestimation. I usually work three screens. Now, I live in New York, live in Brooklyn, two-bedroom apartment with my wife and daughter, 900 square feet. So we only have one big TV. My wife, if I am home on a Saturday, my wife and daughter usually just go somewhere. And I'll have the TV, my computer, my laptop, and my phone working a game each on there, and sometimes I'll work in a tablet, an iPad. So three to four screens is generally as much as I, because really any more than that, it becomes a little too staticky.
Going back to pre-internet days, the gap or the wall between a writer and fans was so large. Mm-hmm. Now you're interacting with fans all the time through Twitter. I guess the positive, at least from my perspective, is there's accountability.
Mm-hmm.
If you get something wrong, you're going to know about it.
Yeah.
Maybe the negative is, why is everybody so damn mad all the time?
I get a lot of why is everybody so damn mad, especially it's an odd in college football. I find, I will never, ever begrudge or slight college football fans. They are the reason why I have a job that I like very much. But I do notice there is a passion that sort of tends to lead towards a little bit of like an angst in college football that is not like any other sport. And sort of a negativity that I don't love, but I do love. I don't do much beyond Twitter. I know there are other social media platforms that people engage on, but Twitter is sort of my thing. And I like Twitter in that it's allowed me to sort of... The AP is a place of sort of birth in anonymity. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to be anonymous these days and do this job. When I say this job, the job of a reporter, well. So it helps me to raise my profile a little bit. I like engaging with the fans a little bit. I think that can be fun. You get some back and forth. I like the accountability aspect. And it just sort of gives me a little bit of a voice behind sort of this anonymous AP byline.
I guess you started focusing more on Clemson and developing those relationships with Dabo and others there around 2015 or so when they started going to the playoff. Mm-hmm. What strikes you the most about this run that they're on, which doesn't really, it's not showing many signs of waning?
A couple of things. It is remarkable to me how much fun they seem to have at Clemson. And I always try to preface and qualify. I see coaches less frequently than beat writers do. So I have a very different relationship with coaches, and sometimes that relationship influences my opinion of coaches differently than guys who work with them every day. And you're in South Carolina. So a perfect example of that was national writers love Steve Spurrier because he was accessible and he was funny and he was blunt. But if you covered, as people who live in South Carolina know, covered Steve Spurrier every day, maybe not the most fun thing in the world. Like, he could be a little cantankerous, yeah. Right? So my perception of Dabo has always been incredibly accessible, simply, you know, good to always, again, fills your notebook. So I am very much impressed by the fact that that program seems to have managed to figure out a way to be super successful without taking itself too seriously. That theme of sort of, and I wrote about Christian Wilkins yesterday, and a lot of it was about what a fun guy he is and how that's like, that's sort of the personality of Clemson to a certain degree, and how Dabo is a person who, again, I think allows his team to have a little personality and have some fun with it and not be jaded. And I think the thing I've sort of pitched to my editors is, like, I feel like Clemson is the happiest place in the country. Mm-hmm. I think the fans are not jaded yet. Maybe you sense that a little more, but I think that there's still this, like, hey man, this is just the best it's ever been, and we enjoy it. And I appreciate that in Clemson. Compare and contrast to Alabama, where, listen, I mean, the success level at Alabama is literally unprecedented. But I often wonder if anybody is having any fun, including the fans. Because Saban's got a machine going on there. And listen, it's fun to win. So ultimately, it's fun. It's fun to win. It's fun to win championships. And it's fun to go to the NFL and make millions of dollars. So everybody involved in there is definitely doing okay. But I do wonder if, like, anybody's having fun. So that's the thing that most stands out to me with Clemson. In some ways, it's just the element that everybody seems to be really appreciative right now. The program, the people around the program. The other thing is, you know, just how Dabo sort of goes about his business. And I think he strikes me as sincere when he talks about culture and being bigger than the scoreboard. And you talk about, like, the kids that go through the program. There's some little things that jump out to me about Clemson, about, you know, the lack of attrition on the roster. I was going through some for a story I did on recruiting the other day and noticed, like, all these fifth-year players and who may have been big recruits but don't really play much of a role now. And I find myself thinking, like, those guys don't stay at other programs. If you look back 5 years at other rosters, there's maybe two or three players, four or five players, but they're playing. Like, you don't hang around a place and not play for 4 years in college football generally. But that seems to happen at Clemson, which leads me to believe that what Dabo's selling maybe is genuine.
Yeah, not as much processing of players who don't pan out. And Dabo has said, you've probably heard it, when he makes an offer to a player and his parents, his family, it's till graduation do we part.
Mm-hmm.
And it definitely, the numbers certainly underscore that. You, before we started this interview, you finished your preview for the game.
Yeah.
How do you see this shaking out?
The theme that I sort of went through is it was a little more Notre Dame focused. And quite frankly, my feeling was, I think I'm going to be writing more about Clemson after this game. So let's give Notre Dame a ride. Listen, I think that as much as Notre Dame has tried to downplay this, this is something of a measuring stick game for them. I think that Kelly, the program, is healthier than it has been in a long time. I think I've always been impressed with Kelly. I've probably been a bigger supporter of Brian Kelly as a coach than most people. I know he's not a guy who people easily warm up to, but I think he's really good at his job. If you want to get down to the X's and O's of it, I don't see a lot of very obvious places where Notre Dame has an advantage. The big receivers against the Clemson D-backs, There might be something there. Notre Dame is not a great stretch the field passing game. They're the heart of their passing game, and the reason why they went to Book is because he's good intermediate, and he's very accurate short to intermediate. You know, do they use that to replace the running game? Because I think it's going to be, even without Lawrence, I think it's going to be really hard for Notre Dame to run. I think that's maybe the one pivotal thing about Lawrence being out. And listen, I know Clemson has good players behind him. Is, you know, I wasn't sure when Notre Dame was going to be able to run the ball at all. Maybe there's a path here for them to average 4 yards a carry.
That's what I keep going back to as well, because Notre Dame is a good-looking team. Probably better than most national observers give him credit for, at least from my view of it. But Brent Venables with extra time to prepare. I went back earlier today, and it, over his 6 seasons as defensive coordinator, when he's had all of December to prepare for either a bowl game or a semifinal, in 2012, his first year, LSU was averaged 180 yards rushing a game versus everyone else. They got 99 that night. The next year, Ohio State was averaging 317 against everybody else, 193 against Clemson. Oklahoma in 2014, the Russell Athletic Bowl, was averaging 268. They got 172 against Clemson. 2015, Orange Bowl semifinal, Oklahoma was averaging 235. They got 67. 2016, Ohio State and Urban Meyer,
which was just a disaster.
We're averaging 258 on the ground and got 88. Alabama last year, Alabama, you know, runs on just about everybody, was averaging 259. They got 141. So Clemson in those 6 games held those opponents' running attacks to an average of 126 yards less than they averaged against everybody else. And so it's like, we know, I mean, if this defense can take away the run, it's like an offense playing with one hand tied behind his back. And that's what he does. That's what he specializes in.
This is not, if, you know, listen, I Clemson fans are good college football fans, but I don't know how much they may have really tuned into Notre Dame. If you're thinking a little bit back to last year's Notre Dame team and that offensive line, it's very different. I mean, they you know, McGlinchey and Nelson were maybe the two best offensive linemen in college football last year, and Notre Dame just rode those guys. They have talent on the offensive line. There are still like NFL level players here, but they were mixing and matching. The best player is probably Alex Bars, and he got hurt, the guard. Mustafa's pretty good at center. Like, I don't necessarily, you know, this is not a bunch of NFL guys against a bunch of NFL guys. So again, I don't want to downplay Notre Dame. They've got good players, but this is not that Notre Dame offensive line. And yeah, I just don't know where that. So again, my question becomes, I like Chip Long, the Notre Dame offensive coordinator. I think he's a pretty smart dude. Is how do they replace the running game, and can they replace the running game with the passing game? Can they just go quick game and intermediate stuff? Because that's in. And also, can they get Book involved in the running game a little bit? He's pretty, you know, he's not Wimbush, but he's pretty slippery. You know, he's not a statue. So forget about the traditional run game. I'll go back to Mike Leach always talks about balance is ridiculous. Balance is not run and pass. Balance is balancing out who touches the ball and how. And I wonder if that is a that might be the way Notre Dame goes. Balance, but not like traditional balance. Balance with, like, we're just going to come up with a lot of different ways for people to touch the ball.
You can take this or leave it, but you mentioned Clemson fans being real smart and all that. Who are the worst fans, or the fans that are hardest to deal with? I don't want to say worst, the hardest to deal with on social media.
I mean, listen, Alabama fans are a major presence right now, and they have a tendency to insert themselves into every discussion with Alabama as the backdrop. Like, if you're I will always kid around that Alabama fans on Twitter are like the guy who walks into the middle of a conversation about the party and just starts talking about himself.
I thought those were Ohio State fans.
Well, there's a little bit of that there. Ohio State, listen, we've gotten to take when there's a scandal, you get a taste of what fans can be difficult. But I will always say this. I think every fan base has its crazies.
Yeah.
Right? Who can be a little difficult. I think the SEC fans tend to be... because of, let's just take SEC fans in general. I think because the SEC has been so dominant, they sort of have a little bit of a delusion of grandeur about just like how great their conference is. Yeah. And I think that becomes sort of can be a little bit of an annoyance at times.
You mentioned how fans can be really bad during scandals. The most remarkable thing over the last, one of the most remarkable developments over the last 4 or so years has been the death of FSU Twitter. They're gone. I mean, there might as well be a tombstone. They're not. Where are they? What happened?
You know, the biggest thing I try to sort of get across to fans in general is that everybody just sort of takes... When something bad happens, everybody sort of roots for their uniform. So even when, like, that, you know, listen, Florida State, right, for a couple of years there with that Jameis team, there was a lot going on there, and those fans were tough to deal with. But even when the folks who are sort of taking the other side and being, you know, like, everybody's just sort of rooting against, for or against the uniforms, which becomes kind of like, I hate even dipping a toe into that water, quite frankly. It's like, you know what? You don't really care about this issue. You just sort of care about your team. And if it was, and if the same thing happened on your team, my guess is you'd probably be defending, you know, absolutely, your guy, as opposed to, like, you know, calling that guy a disgrace.
Fans are really eager to attach bias to writers. Mm-hmm. So in the cases of beat writers, it's pretty easy. They say you're a homer, mm-hmm, for that team. Or whatever, but with you, you're not aligned. You don't cover a particular team. What is their how does their bias sort of meter work with you?
I think it's whoever you praise. I think any praise of any program becomes something that's perceived as a slight towards them, right? So hence, you must have some type of bias towards that program. So, yeah, I think it's a moving target. I think anybody who sort of does sort of the broad 30,000 feet view, you can be accused of being, you know, SEC bias one day or an SEC hater the next day. And my job is to sort of try to be able to do a little bit of both. Right. I was kidding around. I remember, like, during one of these little Twitter sessions during when we're trying to pick playoff teams, right? I like to get online and, like, sort of like, hey, what about this scenario? I like doing that with the fans. And I realized within 10 minutes I argued for and against Ohio State being in the playoff, because I think that's sort of my job. My job, yeah, is like, if you want my opinion, I'll give it to you. But I'm also, my biggest job is to sort of say, like, here's the pros, here's the cons. You figure it out.
I say this to people all the time. If you guys had any idea how little we cared about a result, like, we walk out of the press box, we're happy regardless because our work day is over, you know, looking for a place to get a beer.
It really is. It really is.
Ralph, I know you're a busy man, so particularly spur of the moment, I just approached you about this morning, so I really appreciate you making time for me.
Larry, thanks so much, and it was a pleasure. It's always good running into you, and maybe Santa Clara.
Absolutely. Take care. Thank you. Okay, thanks so much to Ralph Russo, National College Football writer for the Associated Press. Very generous with his time. Also, thanks to our sponsors, title sponsor Parham Smith and Arch and Hull Law Firm in downtown Greenville. Get yourself a koozie from there if you already haven't, a Clemson Dubcast koozie that they've been so kind to produce for us. Also, the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson and Tandem Payment in Greenville. Thanks to all of our sponsors for making this happen. Thanks most of all for all of you for making this happen and making it a part of your routine. Next podcast scheduled to drop early next week. Don't know exactly when yet, but it's a good one. Already recorded that. I'm really looking forward to bringing that to you folks. Everybody have a great weekend. Enjoy the game and be safe. Cheers.